Picture this. It's the dead of night. Helicopters are slicing through the air, deep, deep inside enemy territory. It feels like something out of a movie, right? But it's this incredibly audacious gamble to rescue American POWs.
And that's exactly what we're digging into today. This is episode 48, the Suntay Prison Raid, also known as Operation Ivory Coast.
Yeah, Ivory Coast. And for this deep dive, you're getting something really special.
We are. Our main source, it's a first-hand account. Someone who was actually there, one of the raiders on the ground during this mission. It gives you this, well, unparalleled look at the planning, the execution.
Which sounds absolutely heart-stopping.
Oh, it was. And, you know, the unexpected twists and turns it took. It's not just the official story.
Exactly. We're not just, laying out a timeline. Our mission here is to really get into the complexity, the sheer guts involved, and what the real impact of this raid actually was. Forget the Hollywood stuff.
Let's get to the core of it.
Okay, let's unpack how this whole incredible thing even started.
Well, you really need to understand the context first.
Yeah.
By 1970, the situation for American POWs in North Vietnam was, frankly, desperate.
Yeah.
Our source, he highlights this devastating number. 114 POWs had already died in captivity.
Wow.
And across 13 different camps, there were 591 Americans being held. Many, for over 5 years. One guy, 9 years.
9 years. Just imagine that, almost a decade. And it really drives home that whole no man left behind idea, doesn't it? Our source really emphasizes that.
It wasn't just a slogan.
No.
No, it was this powerful conviction, and it really fueled this whole operation.
So the planning kicks off when April 1970.
Yeah, April 70,
Yeah.
spearheaded by General Blackburn. And what's interesting about Blackburn is his background. He had experience with partisan forces in World War II.
Ah, okay. So unconventional warfare.
Exactly. And that probably shaped how he approached this kind of specialized rescue mission.
And initially, the intel, the reconnaissance, it looked like POWs were at Suntay, right?
Yeah.
SR-71s, drones.
Right. The early imagery, the photos, they suggested prisoners were there. But, and this is a huge but, the POWs had actually already been moved.
Ah, so the intel was dated.
Crucially dated. Field sources confirmed it later, after the raid, obviously. They'd have been shifted to another camp called Camp Hope.
Why? What happened?
Apparently, the well at Suntay went dry.
Well,
Just bad luck. So the initial intel wasn't wrong when it was gathered, but the ground truth changed.
that highlights that classic intelligence dilemma, doesn't it? Getting fresh info versus tipping off the enemy.
Absolutely, a real tension there.
So why didn't they know? Why stop the overflights if the situation could change?
Well, our source explains that. They deliberately stopped flying over Suntay. The idea was, don't let the North Vietnamese know we're that interested in this specific camp.
Prioritize surprise over constant updates.
It was a calculated risk, a big one.
A real catch-22, like you said. So why Suntay in the first place, then? What made it stand out?
Access, mainly. Ease of getting in, and crucially, getting out quickly with potentially rescued POWs. Its location, about 23 miles northwest of Hanoi, right on the Song River, it just seemed logistically sound on paper.
And the size of the force needed, sounds like there was some debate there. Army wanted 200, SEALs thought 12.
Yeah, quite a range. Ultimately, they settled on this specialized group of 56 raiders. But the big unknown, the really terrifying variable, was how the guards would react.
Right. Would they fight, flee, or worse?
Exactly. Would orders be to kill the POWs? They just didn't know. And that lack of intel directly shaped the assault plan. It had to be incredibly fast, overwhelming.
Which leads to that absolutely audacious tactic.
It really does. They figured they needed total control of those guards within like 30 to 60 seconds, just an incredibly tight window.
How do you even do that?
Well, their answer was crash a helicopter
Yeah.
deliberately, right inside the compound walls.
You're kidding. A planned crash landing.
That was the plan. Deliver the assault team instantly, right into the heart of it.
And this is near Hanoi, right? You said 23 miles. Weren't there tens of thousands of NVA troops around?
Oh, yeah. Estimates were anywhere from 20,000 to 80,000 NVA in the greater Hanoi area. The odds looked, well, pretty daunting from the start.
Understatement. So who were these guys who actually volunteered for this? Let's talk about the team.
Right, the volunteers. Our source speaks incredibly highly of Colonel Arthur "Bull" Simons, calls him a legend in special forces.
And his background. Bataan Death March, Kevinauchuan prison camp survivor. He knew what this was about firsthand.
Absolutely. He had lived through the absolute worst of it. He was the obvious choice to select and train these guys.
And initially, lots of interest. 1,500 volunteers.
Yeah, huge initial interest at Fort Bragg. But then our source mentions this slightly odd detail. The numbers dropped way off when they found out TDY, temporary duty pay, wasn't available for the training.
Huh. Even for heroes, practicalities matter.
It seems so. But the selection that followed was intense. Personal interviews by command sergeant majors. And some really weird questions, apparently.
Like what?
Our source, he was just an E5 then, a young buck sergeant, remembers being asked about scuba diving, welding, things you wouldn't normally associate with a raid.
Looking for adaptability, maybe? Resourcefulness?
Could be. It's interesting, though, that our source, relatively junior, got picked for the advanced team. They were clearly looking beyond just rank.
And they ended up training at Eglin Air Force Base in Florida.
Right. Chosen because they had the right aircraft there, specifically the H-53 helicopters needed for the raid. But even before that, the first thing they did was write their wills.
Wow.
No.
That certainly sets the tone, a stark reminder.
Really brings home the danger, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And the training itself is incredibly detailed. They built a full-scale mock-up of Suntay.
With what? Plywood? Concrete?
No, get this. Target cloths stretched over 2x4s. Our source jokes it was like toilet paper on a stick. But, and this is key, it was guarded tooth and nail and 4/7. Shoot-to-kill orders. Absolute secrecy was paramount, even with this flimsy mock-up.
So they're practicing on this basic model, but with deadly seriousness. Did they practice specific skills?
Oh, yeah. Specialized gear, like a settling torch for cutting chains or locks, just in case. The first month was MOS skills, refresh demolitions for our source, plus intense physical conditioning.
Gotta be in peak shape.
Absolutely. They had three assault teams. Red Wine, that was our source's team, Greenleaf, and Blue Boy. Blue Boy was the chopper designated for that crash landing.
And they rehearsed a lot.
Over 170 times.
Yes.
Our source stresses it wasn't just repetition. They constantly changed things, threw in curveballs, honing teamwork, accuracy, entry methods, building that shared understanding so they could improvise under fire.
Smart, not just muscle memory.
Exactly. They even trained for the psychological side, simulating how POWs might react after years of captivity, maybe confused, maybe even hostile initially.
Covering all the bases. And working with the Air Force pilots must have been crucial.
Hugely important. Our source praises them highly. Practicing those insertions, extractions, again and again. And most of it, about 80%, was done at night.
Under flares dropped by C-130s.
Yeah. Talk about realistic conditions. And their night vision tech. Kind of surprising.
What was it? State of the art.
Actually, World War II surplus ski goggles with amber lenses. Apparently chosen partly because they looked cool.
You're kidding. WWII goggles.
That's what he says. And initially, their night shooting accuracy was terrible, like 50%. Bull Simons was not happy.
I bet. Not acceptable for this kind of mission.
Definitely not. So they jury-rigged this thing called an armor light scope onto their AR-15s. That boosted accuracy way up to like 95%.
Necessity and invention right there. And what was Barbara?
Barbara. That was another mock-up built by the CIA. This one had a special prism, so you could look through it and constantly see the layout from ground level, really internalize it. Very innovative.
Incredible ingenuity. So the teams were small, right? Two or three guys.
Yeah, broken down into small units with very specific jobs within the bigger plan. Plus, they had alternate plans for everything. What if a chopper goes down?
What was the abort criteria?
Loss of two helicopters. If that happened, the mission was off.
And they trained with live ammo. That sounds unusual for the time.
It was, apparently. But Simons deemed it necessary. And they had to face the grim reality that escape and evasion, if things went wrong. It was pretty much impossible.
So what was the plan B?
Fight their way back to the Song River. That was it. A desperate last stand, basically.
Yeah. Jeez, the pressure must have been immense.
You bet. Our source talks about these Friday night fights, basically letting off steam, sometimes getting a bit out of hand.
Blowing off stress.
Yeah, and even a sort of weird beach outing with some CIA guys, which turned out to be a test to see if anyone had loose lips, checking for leaks.
Constant vigilance. And Pappy Kittleson, the chaplain. What a story.
Amazing, right? 46 years old, WWII vet. And he was actually on the Cabanatuan raid that saved over 500 Americans. Can you imagine?
Wow. Having him there must have meant a lot.
He held this powerful prayer meeting just before they left. Our store says it was incredibly moving, sort of grounded them.
And their theme song, Leaving on a Jet Plane.
Yeah. Poignant, huh? Then the long journey. Bragg to Eglin, Norton AFB, Alaska, Japan, finally Takali in Thailand. That's where the CIA had a compound.
Staging area, still secret.
Oh, yeah. Guarded by the Royal Thai Army. Weapons locked up. Lots of rumors flying around. Initially, they thought maybe they were rescuing downed air crews. No one knew it was Suntay yet.
And the team doctor.
a bit of a character.
Dr. Cataldo.
Yeah.
LTC, volunteered, but not much field experience. Apparently had a couple of accidental weapon discharges.
Yeah.
Not ideal.
Yikes. Probably didn't inspire confidence.
Maybe not. But then came the big clue. The pre-mission steak dinner.
Ah, the classic sign-off meal.
Exactly. Everyone knew something major was about to happen.
Yeah.
Then the briefing. Simons finally tells them. Sante. 60, maybe 70 POWs.
What was the reaction?
Electric, our source says. Just absolute focus. Simons laid it out bare. 50-50 chance of not coming back. Still entirely voluntary.
And everyone stayed.
Every single one. Then Simons mentions President Nixon had personally approved it and would take full responsibility. That adds weight, doesn't it?
Huge weight. Then the final checks.
Weapons, ammo, radios. Our source was an RTO, radio telephone operator. Got some simple advice from the older guys? Don't hesitate.
Good advice.
Probably the best advice. Then loading onto C-130's flight to Udorn in Thailand.
Yeah.
And then this incredibly hairy mid-air refueling.
At night.
At night, no lights, no radio comms, flying basically treetop level, near stalling speed, right in the C-130's prop wash. Just unbelievably dangerous before they even got close.
Wow.
Then the 3.5-hour flight towards Sante. Our source remembers thinking about being best man at his friend's wedding, weighing the risks. Very real, very human thoughts.
Especially knowing what was waiting, SAM sites nearby.
Oh, yeah. Big threat. Anti-aircraft fire, too. In fact, 20 SAMs were fired that night in the general confusion.
20? How did they avoid getting hit?
It's partly luck, partly the diversion. This massive air operation over Hanoi, 116 aircraft dropping flares, confusing the North Vietnamese radar and air defenses, keeping their MiGs grounded.
A huge coordinated effort.
Absolutely critical for that element of surprise. And then the raid begins.
Blue Boy coming in.
Right. But the trees were taller than expected.
Yeah.
Rotor blade hits, throws things off immediately. First man out, deployed early, unintentionally, and his cousin was supposedly in Sante. Just incredible irony.
Unbelievable. And the guard towers?
Two cleared by the supporting choppers, but the third one needed taking out fast after the crash. Then, the radio crackles. Alternate plan green.
What did that mean?
Greenleaf's chopper was in trouble. Engine failure, maybe hit, they weren't sure. Bottom line, 22 fewer raiders on the ground initially, and Bill Simons wasn't with the first wave.
So red wine, our sources team, suddenly they're the main effort?
Instantly. Huge shift in the plan, right under fire. And the miniguns from the support choppers, 4,000 rounds a minute. Our source says the pucker factor went way, way up.
I can only imagine his first combat too, right?
Yeah. Exiting the down chopper, tracers flying, but he says there was no hesitation, just reacted. Engaged the enemy.
Clearing the buildings, concussion grenades, crisscross fire.
That was the drill. Captain Turner and our source leading the way. And the order for the NVA guards was clear. Take no prisoners. Grim, but that was the reality.
They reached the communications building.
And then they hear it. The message nobody wanted to hear.
Yeah.
Negative items.
No POWs.
None. Devastating after everything. All that planning, risk. For nothing, it seemed at that moment.
Must have been crushing. But then there's that twist with the Greenleaf helicopter.
Yeah, this is wild. Greenleaf, trying to make an emergency landing, accidentally sets down near a secondary school, not the prison.
A school?
Turns out it was full of Chinese or maybe Russian advisors training the NVA on SAM's other advanced weapons. Greenleaf engaged them, neutralized a significant number.
Wow, an accidental firefight.
And our source genuinely believes that engagement might have saved them, the Red Wine team. By taking out those trainers before they could react to the main raid. Just pure, unpredictable chance of combat.
A mission within a mission, completely unplanned. So Greenleaf eventually got back to Sante.
Yeah, they got picked up, redeployed to the main compound. But it just confirmed the bad news. They blasted a hole in a wall. Dick Meadows got on the bullhorn, called out, nothing. Raiders searched cell by cell. Simons himself checked, empty.
So regrouping, extraction. Knowing the main objective failed.
Must have been surreal. Choppers waiting nearby, engines hot, reloading ammo, quick head count, bit of panic when they thought they were one man short, but it was a miscount.
Thank goodness.
Then lifting off, seeing the lights of Hanoi, just this bizarre mix of relief, only one minor injury in the whole force, and utter frustration.
But the danger wasn't over yet, was it?
Not by a long shot. Their chopper gets hit by a SAM. A direct hit. Starts dropping like a stone.
Terrifying.
Absolutely terrifying. Miraculously, they survived it. But an F-104 escort fighter was lost. Pilot ejected, spent the night hiding on a hillside.
Was he rescued?
Yeah, picked up the next morning. So, incredibly, zero U.S. personnel lost in the entire operation. But the mood returning was disappointment. frustration.
And the official story was just a training exercise.
Pretty much. Training exercise gone wrong? Seemed unbelievable given the scale of things.
But then Hanoi kind of blew their cover.
Ironically, yes. They announced they'd been bombed. They were probably talking about the diversionary flares, but they specifically mentioned a raid on a POW camp that let the cat out of the bag globally.
And the aftermath, the impact on the POWs. That's maybe the most important part.
Absolutely, and this is key. Our sources had former POWs tell them directly. After the raid, their treatment got significantly better.
Really? How so?
The North Vietnamese realized these guys weren't forgotten, that the U.S. would try something this audacious. So while the raid didn't free anyone that night, it was absolutely not a failure from the POW's perspective.
It gave them hope, proof someone was trying.
Exactly. Lifted their spirits immensely. There's this detail about paper cutouts the guards put up the next day meant to scare them, but it just confirmed the raid happened.
And it led to the consolidation of prisoners.
Right. They move everyone from the smaller camps into the main prisons like the Hanoi Hilton.
Mm.
Overcrowded, yes, but it actually helped the POWs. Better communication between prisoners, stronger internal organization, improved morale overall because they weren't isolated anymore.
So an unintended positive consequence?
A major one. And the raid itself, Sun Tae-si, it became legendary in military circles. It's taught at West Point, other academies, as the model for how to plan and execute a complex rescue.
Even influencing later ops, like the Bin Laden raid.
It's cited as a direct influence, yeah. Its legacy in special operations doctrine is huge.
And there are memorials, reunions.
Still happen. The bond between those guys is incredible. And there's a movie coming out, 27 minutes. They're working with the Sun Tae Raid Association to try and get it right. Really authentic.
Should be fascinating. And Bull Simons, our source's description of him, quiet but intense.
Yeah, gives you a real sense of the man, not just the legend. The anecdote about guard duty paints a picture.
So, wrapping this up, this deep dive into episode 48, the Sun Tae Raid, incredible planning, unbelievable risks.
Mm-hmm. The unexpected outcome, no POWs found, but then this huge positive impact on all the POWs' treatment and morale. It's quite a story.
The aha moments for me are just the training ingenuity, like Barbara, the raw courage of everyone involved, the limits of even the best intelligence, and that core belief, never leave anyone behind.
It makes you, the listener, think, doesn't it, about the complexity of these things, the unpredictable nature of it all. Even meticulous plans hit reality.
Sometimes the biggest impacts are the ones you never planned for.
Precisely. You just have to admire the dedication, the sacrifice.
So the final thought maybe is, even though Operation Ivory Coast didn't achieve its main goal that night, did it actually achieve something maybe even more significant in the long run?
What does that tell us about these kinds of operations?
Yeah.
About the ripple effects? It's definitely something worth considering.